much for coming to this session. I'll be fairly brief. My name's Nick Henderson. I'm from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. I'm sure that everybody's very interested in the subjects that we're discussing today. We'll be opening with Reagan, who's going to be talking about name change and the archives. If anybody hasn't had the opportunity to read biographies, I won't go into the detail, but they're all at the end of your program. So,
hello, everyone. Can everybody hear me? Yes? Excellent. So, hello. My name is Reagan Swanson. I use pronouns she and her, and I'm the executive director at the Archives, Canada's LGBTQ2+ archive. You may remember us as the Canadian Lesbian and Gay Archives. And today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the process of doing a name change, why we did it, why it was needed, and then talk about how we're actually putting it into action rather than just letting the name try to speak for all the things that we're trying to do. I'm going to start off by acknowledging that the archives and myself live on the traditional lands of the Mississaugas, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat, and that we are very grateful to work on the land, and we acknowledge that the Two-Spirit stories that exist in Toronto have not always been kept or have been ignored, and that we're going to work harder in the future to make sure that those stories are represented in our collection and support is given. So, since 1973, the Archives, formerly the Canadian Lesbian and Gay Archives, has been acquiring and preserving material documenting Canada's LGBTQ2+ history. Now, our records are based out of the origins of the Body Politic magazine, and we have had many different names over the years. So while the mandate hasn't changed a lot, the name has, and we've actually had four different names over the length, over the last 46 years. As we approach our 50th year, we are thinking about legacy and who is and who is not represented. And it was only 2.5 years ago that I started at what was then the CLGA, but it only took 1 week before the emails started coming in asking why they were not represented, or why not all community was represented in our name. It took another 2 weeks for the second email to come in, and before I had been there for 2 months, another two had arrived. So knowing that the community was interested and actively querying us about why they were not represented in our title, I moved into the position and knew that we were going to be making some big changes fairly quick. So the mandate includes LGBTQ2+. For those who are unaware and missed Brett's presentation earlier yesterday, Two-Spirit is the term used often by Indigenous communities in Canada, the United States, or as we say, Turtle Island. Now, though the acronym previous to my arrival had simply been LGBTQ, we knew that updating the two and creating a land acknowledgement would be also an important part of the name change and making sure that it was recognized. So where do we come from? We come from the Canadian Gay Liberation Movement Archives, which was the early 1970s, the Canadian Gay Archives in the early 90s when we switched yet again, it was the Canadian Lesbian Gay Archives, and finally the Canadian the Archives, Canada's LGBTQ2+ archive. So name changes were not new to our organization. What was new was the process that we went about, and what we did was we hired consultants. We hired consultants because I'm the only permanent staff member at the organization, and all the other staff that you'll see later on in the slides are all contract-based and a part of our organization thanks to grants and foundational support. This was not a project I could have done alone, but what we did was we created a name change steering committee, which included volunteers who were members of our organization, included a board member, and it included myself as a representative of the staff. The process was two parts. The first was an online survey. The second part was one-on-one interviews. All of this was conducted through the consultants so that anonymity could be preserved, and so people felt free to say whatever they wanted, and they did, about our organization. The data was then presented to us, the steering committee, and then to the board. And then from there, the options of several names were given to the board, and discussions were held about what was most appropriate. So changing the name, while it was a lengthy process, was kind of the easy step of what we needed to do. We knew that we needed to make sure that those communities that were not or did not feel welcome in our organization felt welcome. And we needed to put action to what we were trying to say, right? So what better way than to create a new strategic plan? The strategic plan was created in 2017 and actually started before my arrival. The planning started in 2016. Now, the strategic plan built in the name change, even though it was already in the process. So the improved public profile was part of the name change. We needed to make sure that folks understood that we were not just for lesbian and gays, that we had a mandate that included LGBTQ2+. You know, we were going to try to be more active in that. We needed them to see that the name was, us changing the name was us trying to reach out in this tiny little step. But we needed the other steps to go along with it. So the second was building our collections through building relationships, a diverse and vibrant team, and improve programming. So there's two more steps as part of our strategic plan, but they are a little bit off to the side and talk about how we have no money and how we need more of it. I think everybody is in the same spot, so I just kind of park those to the side. So the improved public programming. Apparently this slide is out of... Apologies. We have something fancy that was created, so I want to make sure that it's seen. Oh, there it goes. So the improved public profile was very important for us. While the question of the name change was brought up at the 2017 annual general meeting, we knew that we needed to act as soon as possible, and because of the way the movement was made at the annual general meeting, we needed to present a name within a year at the next annual general meeting. So we did two separate RFPs, one for the consultants to help us pick a name, and then a second one, which happened later on, to do the logo. Now, the logo needed to be more than just one element. It needed to represent the name, but it also needed to represent and be a part of a larger branding. And so we worked with a local designer to create imagery, to create things like you just saw, that would be able to run on social media and that would be able to give a kind of first step and an introduction to our new name. It was also necessary because the main question we were asked was, how do you pronounce it? So the second part that would be, I'm just going to go back to where it's supposed to be, was a diverse and vibrant team. Now, our organization was founded with the body politic, And the organization of the body politic was a very white and a very male organization. That does not represent who the volunteers are at the archive, but there is that ongoing perception of who we are. Our staff is not just white men, and we needed to make sure that that was also a part of who we were hiring and being active in making sure that we were hiring the kind of people that we wanted to be a part of our organization. So our organization has 8 staff members at the moment. One is not pictured here, as Tobarin is not a fan of having his picture shown. But the organization did shift, and so did our volunteers. And as we brought in new members of staff from various backgrounds, from various gender and just new people into the fold, we were able to see that new volunteers were coming in, and it made a really quick and easy impact. We also started hiring community. So in this case, for our trans project, we hired trans community members to be the ones to be describing our collections. So making sure that the narrative that was being told was in the hands of the community members who were donating the pieces. Programming was another key part. My slides are not working properly, which is also why they're out of order. And I had various examples here. Our programming has expanded to more than just exhibitions within our own institution. And rather, we're partnering with other exhibits, we're partnering with other organizations, and we're trying to make sure that the reach that we have is more than just outside of our building. We're going into public places and to community centers to make sure that we are more visible and that our collection is seen by more people. There is more slides there. Because we have a national mandate, it couldn't just be about Toronto. So we started more and more making sure that we were actively creating digital exhibitions that would be accessible to folks by using Omeka and by making sure that the images and the material that we were putting online was of high enough quality that it was able to be accessible, but low enough that if people had limited bandwidth, they would still be able to access the material. And this has given us a chance to make sure that our name and rebranding is upheld by the actions. So we're not just changing our name and going, okay, check mark, it's done. Rather, we're making sure that all the projects that we have going are part of that name change, making sure that our team and our volunteers are diverse and represent the community, making sure that our exhibitions are reflective of our entire collection. And from here, we're going to see how we're going to measure success, because success to us is meeting those goals that we set out in the strategic plan. It's only been a year. We've already seen a lot of change in the past year, but it will take time, and we know it's going to take time. So how we measure success is kind of going to be up to our members and to our community to decide of how well we're doing and to help guide us in our next phases as we set out to kind of reestablish ourselves and build the next chapter of our organization. So thank you.
Wonderful. Well under time. Okay, now let's pull this next one up. Okay, next we have Joseph Hawkins, Reaching Out, Diversifying One's Collection. And let's see if I can bring that up on screen. Which one is that? It's the one there. That one.
Thanks. Hello, everyone. I know there's a lot of familiar faces in the room here. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about how we've gone about diversifying our collections more, but also about the process that it took us to get to where we are today. Just so that you know, I'm Joseph Hawkins. I teach at the University of Southern California. I started out as an anthropologist. I was studying homosexuality in modern Japan. Somewhere along the way, I got sort of drafted into working on the board of one archives. That was almost 20 years ago soon. I actually collected starting in the late 1990s for the collection. Since then, I've been working there pretty much ever since. 8 years of the time that I worked there, unpaid. So what are some truths? We've been collecting for now 67 years. I'm just counting when Jim Kepner began, along with a number of other people, to collect. So we have about 4 million items, is what I'm saying these days. I haven't counted them all individually, but that's an estimate that we're pretty sure works. We are also pretty solidly the archive of for anything that has to do with mid-20th century in the United States. Our art collections are about 5,000 pieces. We've had a museum for a little while. We had a little space in our own building, and then we opened up a space in the city of West Hollywood, which is, everybody knows, Queer Central in Los Angeles. And so as a result of that, I actually had taken over a loading dock in the back of a building there. They told me I couldn't put a window in. I put it in anyway. I'm like that. And so as a result of that, I ended up having this gallery, which one of our staff says that was originally like Spanky and Darla doing a show in the barn. So it was just badly done, but we went ahead with it anyway. We've redoubled our efforts at the direction of our communities, as the previous speaker was saying. So people come to me, complain about things that we don't have. They come to other people who work at the archive and speak to them, and then we try really hard to respond to whatever their requests are. I'm also conscious that I'm a white, cisgendered university professor, and so that's problematic, but I'll be retiring in 3 years, and so then that won't be a problem any longer. But in the short term, I want you to know that we are doing everything we can, and I've done everything I can to make sure that we're including everybody, and I'm going to show you how that happens. We've published, 4 books have been published out of our collections just in the past year. We're fielding about 1,000 researchers per year, and if you have any idea what an archive does with that, we have only 3 employees, and yet we're doing almost 1,000 people coming through doing research. So it's really an amazing accomplishment. We're severely understaffed and under-resourced. We may be the biggest archive, but we are also incredibly understaffed. We have only 3 people who work there on a full-time basis, and it makes things really, really tough, especially since 2 of us are today here at this conference. We work every day to be representative and to represent social equality. We would not likely be here, by the way, without the generosity of a trans man, Reed Erickson, who in fact in the 1960s gave us funding, which pretty much sustained us for a pretty long time. So, and also I would mention that, just to let you know how far diversity goes back in our organization, the name of the organization, One, is a closeted name. Everything was closeted in the 1950s when things began. And he actually took it from a Carlyle poem, a mystic bond of brotherhood makes all men one, was where it came from. I have the best staff that anybody could ever hope to have. They're just fantastic people. They work themselves into frantic states just to keep things running. So I want to talk about the fact that we're often talked about as a white place for men, but in fact we have lots of women's materials. This material comes from the collection of Lisa Ben. Her name is an anagram for lesbian, and she actually was born Edith Ede, but in between that, and people don't know this, she was actually Tigrina the Devil Doll. She was an occult practitioner, and in fact she worked for RKO Studios as a secretary, where she on carbon copies printed out the first lesbian zine in 1947. She also published in fan magazines. She was a folk singer. And here we have Carolyn Weathers, who's actually here today and sitting in the back row over there. Hi, Carolyn. Anyway, so these women's collections are a part of our materials. This is Carolyn after a bar fight, the left at the top. This is Carolyn at the American Psychiatric Association meetings when the Gay Liberation Front Post protested the conversion therapy session, which was actually going to talk about electroshock therapy for gay people as a cure, and they shut them up. And Carolyn and her friend Jenny Wren are in fact pictured below because they had the Clothespin Fever Press, which was a lesbian press back in the day. We have the women's building materials, but actually we don't have all of them. They're spread out over a number of different places because of the way the women's building decided to distribute them. We also have Jean Cordova's papers. Jean Cordova is a Latina lesbian from Los Angeles who died a few years back. And she basically gave us $30,000 when she gave us collection, which is something that we'd like to make a permanent practice. If we could in fact get everybody to do that, we would really be a lot better place for it. We also have the papers of Betty Berzon, who is a psychotherapist, and that picture up in the corner is her with Eleanor Roosevelt, and also Ivy Bettini, who's just recently retired to Florida, who is a comedian and designed the logo for the women's rights movement. And we have trans collections. On the top left, you see Lynn Edward Harris, born Lynn Elizabeth Harris, or Lynn Edward Harris, and then changed to Lynn Elizabeth Harris because he had Klinefelter syndrome. His mother sort of self-diagnosed after he was taken home, and she, in fact, raised him as a little girl. I processed his papers. Unfortunately, in the processing of his papers, I pronounced him deceased because of the fact that we had been given them anonymously and we were told that he was dying. He then called and corrected me. I then had to have lunch with him right away, and now he's coming to meet with us on a regular basis and to change things that are in his archive, and he has now he prefers the pronoun he, and he in fact has come on a frequent basis and works with us. Transvestia magazine here, and Reed Erickson, who I mentioned before, who is a philanthropist who actually sort of saved us. We also have a large collection of trans magazines, these two are actually made by Angela K. Douglas, who is one of my favorite people, not spoken of a lot, but a trans rights activist who actually ended up in a rock band, and it did all kinds of really interesting things in her life. Our periodicals are actually perhaps the most diverse part of the collections. My favorite magazine title is the one in the middle above. It's a bisexual magazine called Anything That Moves. But we have magazines from all over the world. We've tried, while many archives are trying in the United States to become local to keep down the costs and everything, I have this global aspiration, and so I keep collecting from as far afield as I possibly can get us to have materials. So we also have Japanese materials that I collected when I was doing my research there. This one, I believe, is from Norway, and it's an Iranian magazine. The one at the bottom is a lesbian magazine from Japan, and this one is one of my favorites. It's actually an Esperanto. These also are periodicals that are in our collection, and we have about 8,000 titles in, as far as we know, between 46 and 50 languages. And recently, we've redoubled our efforts in the African American community around us. One of the first national black magazine in the United States was called BLK, and its publisher was a gentleman by the name of Alan Bell. Alan Bell wanted a 30-year anniversary party for the founding of that magazine. He called me, and we talked about it, and we did a great reunion. The photograph is here of that reunion. It includes Phil Wilson, who founded the Black Men's AIDS Project, and Jewel Tice Williams, who opened the first black gay bar in disco bar in Los Angeles, which was really popular. Even Madonna went there at one point. I'm also trying to reach out to other communities that aren't necessarily the ones that we always reach out to. And so I was at another opening for a exhibition that we had done, and a South Asian man came in and said to me, "Do you have anything from India?" And I racked my brain, because often it's not really, I can't remember what things we have, but I'm the person who's been there the longest, so I often do remember. And I remembered this arrest record that I had seen not too far before. So this gentleman, Baba Singh, was arrested in Imperial County for crimes versus nature in 1914 and spent 5 years in a penitentiary. This was the only information that we had, but this young man, Aziz Sohail, was actually so incredibly energetic and excited that he did an entire exhibition around this, which was the 100-year anniversary of the release of Baba Singh, in which we had an event to acknowledge how Baba Singh had been treated and what had gone on perhaps in his life at the time. And this is a South Asian magazine down at the bottom as well. We're also trying really hard to increase our collections of East Asian materials. The communities that are in Los Angeles are giving us materials, but that's not happening as nearly as quickly as I'd like. I've got a lot more stuff that I'm getting from mainland China and Japan, which is really interesting to me. These are Japanese materials that are in our collection that we've just digitized, and I'm actually really excited about this, because some of these magazines were produced in the Taisho period in Japan and contain incredible articles about homosexuality at that time. And over to the left is Johnny Nojima, who was in the United States during World War II. He served in the military, but was also interned at one of the camps at Manzanar, and he was partners with one of the founders of one. About every month or every 2 months, I do a tour for the training of Chinese activists. The Gay and Lesbian Center sends down a group of people. I tour them around the collection, and I do the tour in English. It's simultaneously translated into Chinese. And what's really fantastic about that is that we end up getting Chinese collections. We have a full run of GS, which is a magazine that comes out of Taiwan, as a result of this effort. I've also gotten other materials, and what I'm trying to do now is actually to digitize those as quickly as I can to make them available to people within China in the United States, because some of them sadly don't have access to them within China. Our exhibition and programming is really robust, especially we had a curator named David France, who's unfortunately left us now. He's gone on to the Palm Springs Museum. And the previous curator, Mia Locks, who worked for us, is now the head curator at MoCA in Los Angeles, the Museum of Contemporary Art. So we're a really good training ground for people who want to go on to better careers, apparently. And so we did the exhibition above, Transgender Herstory and 99 Objects. Chris Vargas brought that to us. We did an exhibition for Cheryl Dunier about Watermelon Woman, the film that she did, the early lesbian film. The middle photograph is from Leon Mostovoy, who's a trans man who did photography of lesbian prostitutes in San Francisco during the 1980s. One of my favorite things that we ever did, though, is we cooperated with a Canadian group to produce this Killjoy's Castle. So in the United States, they have these horrifying things in the Midwest where they send high school students into scary houses. And in those scary houses during the Halloween season, they have things like lesbians and gays, abortion, and they're put together by these Christian folks. So this was a response to that. And so there was a lesbian haunted house, and in it there was an entire room of ball busting. There were women looking at their vaginas with mirrors. It was a really big hoot. We had about 4,000 visitors over a 2-weekend period. It was one of the most fantastic things, and there's a book coming out of that now. We also did this one down below. This is Mario Montez, who was in fact a part of the Andy Warhol. He was an Andy Warhol superstar, and we did a retrospective about his career. And this is the biggest thing. And if you want to see this catalog, it's over there at the where we have our display. But the gentleman on the right here is Edmundo Meza. And Edmundo Meza came from Tijuana, Mexico. He immigrated to the United States. Sorry. And while he was in the United States, he started to produce a lot of artwork, and he really did a fantastic job. And Joey Terrell, his friend, produced Homeboy Beautiful, which is over to the left there. So we applied for an exhibition in the Getty in the first round, and we didn't get any money, but they said that we could do an exhibition. So I had to raise $107,000 for that exhibit. The second round, though, we got $500,000, and we produced an exhibition that has a huge catalog, 400 pages. It's gotten 7 awards, and it's toured through 6 different cities in the United States so far. So this exhibition was the biggest effort we ever did. It was really fantastic, and it's really carried our name all the way around the world. And so as a result of that, we're getting more and more visitors and more people coming. And then these are the touring places that it's been to. So I want to end with saying what we're not so good at. We haven't been able to collect around ability issues. We need more women's materials. We'd like to collect more, as most people would, bisexual materials. Native peoples are something that we've never really taken on. The Middle East and Muslim cultures, South Asia, rural America, South and Central America, Africa, these are all things that we're still not doing very well. And so I don't want you to believe that I'm up here bragging about the fact that we've done everything. I know we haven't. We want to do a lot more. But I think we've done a really good job. When I came to one, we were 2% processed, our materials. It was a lot of stuff, but it was only 2% processed. Now we're about 85% processed. So researchers from all over the world come and do research because they can find our materials. So that's it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We're still running a little bit ahead, so that's fantastic. So the last talk that we've got is today is Lois Stone, After the Anniversary, How Momentum from Anniversary Events Can Be Harnessed to Further Inclusivity. So, oh, you've got it down. Yep, sure.
Oh, you started
me
at the end. Oh, it's fine. Who knows, but it's fine. There we go. All right, let's make sure I know where my time is. Hi, so I'm Lois Stone. So I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Manchester in the UK, where I'm currently finishing up my PhD, which is about trans representation in British museums. But today I'm going to be talking about anniversaries and how they can be used by museums and historical sites to further inclusivity. I'm going to be speaking specifically to a project that was at Bolton Museum in Northern England. There is a presentation tomorrow by the coordinator of that project with somebody from the British Museum, so I'm just going to lightly touch on it, and I would really encourage you to go hear more about the project from Pret Squires and Stuart Frost. So like I said, I'm just going to talk briefly about this project and my own role on it, and then I'm just going to talk about some benefits to focusing on anniversaries, some of the pitfalls, some of the things that we found at Bolton that sort of lessons for anybody using working with anniversaries. So 2017 was a very, very, very big year for LGBTQ history in Britain. Some of you might know or remember, I've heard in a different presentation, 2017 was the 50th anniversary of partial decriminalization of homosexuality in England and Wales. And there's no shorter way to say that. I've tried to find it and it doesn't exist. So this meant that homosexual acts were decriminalized for men over the age of 21 when there were only 2 men involved and there was nobody else in the house. Which are details that will become important later. So in 2017, because it was the 50th anniversary, all of a sudden everybody was doing LGBTQ history. For example, just a selection of some of the stuff we had going on was Never Going Underground at the People's History Museum in Manchester. The National Trust did an entire year of programming across England and Wales. There was Tales from the City at the National Museum's Liverpool, Refracted at the Russell Coates Art Gallery and Museum in Bournemouth, Queer British Art at the Tate Britain in London, and Desire, Love, Identity at the British Museum. It's a big year, big year. But I do want to focus on Desire, Love, Identity at the British Museum for a minute. So the exhibit consisted of two parts, an exhibit in a small gallery and then a walking trail around the permanent collections of the museum. It's still available online, and you can hear about it tomorrow. But what happened next was that Desire, Love, Identity became a touring exhibition, and other museums were invited to apply for it. Bolton applied. And as part of their application, included that in 2019, it would be the 20-year anniversary. I have a picture of when it came. The 20-year anniversary of the Bolton Seven, which was a really infamous court case in British history. It involved seven men who were tried for gross obscenity because they'd filmed themselves having sex. At the time, one of the men was 17, and at that point, the age of consent for homosexual acts had been lowered to 18, but the heterosexual age of consent was 16. There was massive international public outcry about the case, and was one of really the cause for the law being changed so the age of consent was equalized. 2019 was also the 20-year anniversary of that case, and it was also the 200th birthday of Walt Whitman, and Whitman has a very strong connection in Bolton. So that was part of the application. So you had two anniversaries being invoked as part of this. So I came to work at Bolton through a placement program at the university. They wanted somebody to help study LGBTQ history. That's what I do. Match made in queer history heaven. So they told me about the anniversary. It was like, this is a place to start. So it was like, let's focus on these. This is where we're going. The opening was incredibly successful. This picture is from the opening night. It's just part of the crowd. And the final exhibit included loaned items from the British Museum, items about Bolt 7, items about Whitman and the 200th birthday, and then just other information that I found while I was living down in their strong room. So some advantages to anniversaries from stuff that we found. So at anniversary, it's a time everybody can get really, really excited about your institution and what you're doing. So building on and capitalizing connections with local communities. One of the phenomenal things about working on Bolton is that they'd already put in a lot of work. Perrette, who I don't know if I was actually in this room. Oh, hello. Has been at the museum for 15 years and is also very active in bi-activism and has been already working in the museum to collect LGBT material. The museum had done a massive renovation just before this exhibit opened, and as part of it, they built in an LGBT trail of the museum. And so just walking around, there's already, you know, rainbow flags on appropriate objects, and there's information there. It gets communities excited about the venue. So they're was an already an LGBTQ youth group that met in the building regularly, but it brought in a couple other groups. There's particularly a group in Bolton, the Rainbow Community, which is in a sort of rougher area of Bolton, and it got them involved to come in and made the museum a safe space for that group. It opened up funding, so because it was the Whitman anniversary, the University of Bolton was doing all sorts of events, and we were able to pull from them to get money to borrow some objects from other places. It also, you know, got the University of Manchester to fund me to be there. So it just opened up money. It connects with other institutions. So, you know, working with Bolton, we also worked with the University of Social Justice in Nottingham, made connections with the Ashmolean. We worked with Sheffield Archives to get other material on. And then it launched the Stage of a Next project. So in this case, this is for the British Museum. They were able to use this anniversary to launch. It's still a touring exhibit and is still developing. And then one of the things that I love is I've got this quote from Tom Freshwater, who's from National Trust, who said, when you chime in with things happening in the wider world, you can make more conversations. So this means you can make the conversations about LGBT history. But one of the great things, I think, is that when you're working around an anniversary, you're not the only person involved in that conversation. So for a place like Bolton, you know, it's never going to be able to cover every LGBT history in the country or in the world or whatever, but we can talk about Bolton's history. But we know that there are other places that are talking about other histories at the same time, and we can put all of these things in conversation in a way that they wouldn't have been able to before. So some of the pitfalls is you've obviously got that it can seem like box ticking, that it's just like, oh, we're doing this. I know that there's a lot of sentiment in the UK right now around how the National Trust is at it, because they had their queer year, they had their woman year. I think this year is the year of civil unrest. So it can feel like that if there's no legacy built into the project. It can leave groups feeling betrayed if you've brought in those new groups to work with you and there's no actual follow through. It also means that you're less likely to get a yes if you've dropped them off after that anniversary. And then one of the other things is that visitors need reinforcing lessons or examples in order to enact a change in their life. So there's a study done by Jennifer Berggren about activist museums and found that visitors would often leave an activist museum or exhibit feeling like they'd changed their thinking or they were going to get involved in their community. But unless there was something else, either when they went home or in another part of the museum to reinforce that, it wasn't going to stick. So I've got a quote that I'm going to show you, but I just want to set up. So it's from someone that Berggren interviewed, who worked at the Center for Civil and Human Rights in the USA, who had at the center, they have, you know, gender-neutral toilets, and a visitor approached them feeling uncomfortable. So this person who was interviewed said, "I said the reason why these bathrooms don't have a gender is because one of the things we are concerned about as the Center for Civil and Human Rights is gender equality for transgender people, for men, for women, for parents who need to breastfeed. All range of people should be accepted here." She was like, "Oh, if I didn't have a gender that I felt comfortable with, I can go to either of those bathrooms." I said, "Exactly." Then I saw her another half an hour later, and she was like, "You should tell everyone." And I was like, "You should tell everyone. You came in here, you changed your mind about something." And she was like, "Yeah, I will. I'm proud of this." So if you have a museum that's doing an anniversary exhibit and whatever is being talked about, the LGBT history and the anniversary, and it is not in the rest of the museum, if it's not in the fabric, not just the toilets, but if there's no other queer stuff mentioned anywhere else, then there's not that solidifying for people that this is an important thing. It's just like, oh, this is the one queer room. So it really needs to be built into the rest of that. So to make anniversaries work, I'm buzzing through this. Oh, sorry, guys. So I have this quote that was from the Queer Legacies Conference 2 years ago, which was specifically about how do we build on the momentum of sort of the gay year in the UK, from people who worked in Amsterdam. And they said, "You're not looking at an exhibition. You're looking at a process of inclusion." And I think that's one of the biggest things, is that whatever you do this anniversary for, is that it has to be part of a process on behalf of the anniversary. So big things is that there needs to be groundwork. So like I said, Perrette had already been doing lots of work in the museum, and the museum already had a walking trail. But it also meant that lots of the staff was already on board. So when I was coming in and I was saying, "Hey, hello, like, lovely archivist, I'm looking for the gay stuff," she was like, "Yeah, cool, like, here's what I know already, here's where we're going." That didn't take any inclusion. And also me coming in, it meant that I felt safe to be in that space, to really work with everybody there. The staff definitely needs to be on board. One of the amazing things about Bolton Museum is that it lives in the same building as the city's central library and also their aquarium. And the staff really works together. So the librarians were incredibly on board. They approached the team working on the exhibit and said, "You know, are there any books that you want us to book in?" They were able to, you know, have some events that were in there. So the staff was already proactive and were asking about what they could be doing when they saw that this exhibit was coming. So take advantage of the things I talked about. So really be looking out for who has the pots of money. Who can you convince to give you the pots of money because it's an anniversary? Who's going to be, you know, who's going to take that sheen? I think I'm very all for exploiting whatever tools are already in place. And that's definitely one of them. What's shiny and what can we you know, repurpose for our queer purposes? So you should already have friends in place. There's a book from Kimberly Kenny called Interpreting Anniversaries and Milestones at Museums and Historic Sites, and she talks about how one of the most important things is that you already need to have your friends before you start asking them for favors. I also want to leave you with a quote from Kenny's book. It's from the Elizabeth Macmillan director, John Gray, and the Honorable Nicholas Taubman from the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. And they said, anniversaries are more than milestones. They are crossroads at which we decide whether to live in the past or to use our experiences to inform and empower the future. And I think what I really want to try to leave you all with today is that anniversaries are part of this. They're a way to foster inclusion, but that decision about whether or not to live in the past or to empower the future already has to be made by the time you get around to the university. The anniversary. The anniversary is a tool in a museum's toolkit, but it cannot and should not be either the start or end of the conversation. Thank you. Get in touch.
Well, I think I might take one of the suggestions which has been used in a few of the panels and sessions so far, which is to ask everybody to turn to their neighbour or to someone behind them and have a bit of a chat about the presentations that have been up here, and just to formulate a question or two and some reflections that you might like to ask the panellists who will be coming up, and particularly those questions that you think might be able to be reflected on by all of the speakers. So if you want to have a couple of minutes to do that, that'd be great, and then we'll come back. But I thought we might kick this off. Now, do we have another microphone for the audience? Oh, it's up here. Wonderful. Too easy. Okay. Thank you so much. Yes, I will. Does anybody have some questions off the bat that they were burning to share with everybody? Would you like to? Yeah.
So I was wondering, because of the name change discussions, and some of you went through that, because I'm also familiar with them from the archive I volunteer at. So how hard was it to find you spoke to it more in terms of the Canada, but do you ever have discussions at one? Have you encountered other discussions? Because I know it's often quite a bit of an issue between generations as well. Older lesbian women feeling that they're going to vanish if you change the name, and I absolutely understand that, but then younger people not feeling reflected anymore, all of these things. So I was wondering how you have dealt with that. Also, maybe in exhibitions, like terminology and all of that.
I can start off. Our survey showed that the line was very clear and it was very generational. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about what people wanted. The older folks did not want to see the word queer appear anywhere. Younger generation, approximately 90% of the people that answered it identified only as queer. So it said a lot to us, and we had to balance that. And so one of the ways was to hint at with a Q in the name, but without... There was no way we could have a name that included the acronyms and the initialism. So we just invented a word, basically, to represent what we were trying to convey, and then went from there. As to terminology, we had this conversation with one of our groups. We had a group of students that came in and worked with the Mira Soleil Ross collection, who is a transsexual artist and activist out of Montreal and Toronto in the 90s. And Mira's work is all about gender. It is about animal activism. It is all over the place. But she's very specific about how she wants to be identified, and she wants to be identified as a transsexual. And the students that were working on the project were really uncomfortable with this terminology. So we added a separate section to the exhibition that just talks about that, about how these were, I think, three trans and one gender nonconforming students that were working on this project, and how they grappled with the language when it was a question of, like, how someone identifies themselves.
One's had so many names throughout history that I couldn't even list them all. But The one that's stuck, actually, is the One Institute. People still call us the One Institute. And to be perfectly frank with you, I like it a lot. We're now called, actually, technically, the One Archives at the University of Southern California Libraries, which I never, ever, ever say completely out. I just say One Archives at USC Libraries in the short form. But I really would rather that wasn't even it, because we've moved on in a number of different ways from being an archive. We're actually now as much a cultural institution, and the argument that I'm constantly trying to make, I mean, just to give you an idea, One is no longer to people just an archive at all. I mean, people come, the day that Trump was elected, there were 14 people that came to the building, five of whom were just sitting there crying. And it was just, it made me feel really good because it was a safe space and they knew it and that's what they thought of it as. So everybody kind of calls us One and that's all they've ever really said. So that name's the one that's sort of the branding fixed for. So I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but my guess is that someday we'll probably have to go back to the One Institute because that's what everybody calls us, even though we've changed our name a number of times. And as to the terminology that we use, it's changed so rapidly, and my experience is exactly like yours. Our when I first started 20 years ago, no one wanted anything in the mail. We had to send closeted mail because no one wanted anything to come to their home with the words gay or lesbian on the envelope. So we couldn't do that. And even in Jim Kepner's time, they only put the One Institute on it. So those things haven't changed in some ways for some of the folks that we are still having around that say they don't want the word queer ever used in relation to them. So we don't do that for them, but we also feel like One works in that way as well because people just refer to us as One and they know that. So it doesn't require that we really spell it out. And also that the alphabet thing has gotten so complicated as the other terminology that I think One sort of elides all of that in some really wonderful way.
Lois?
I mean, I can speak a little to terminology, but obviously name is not an issue at Bolton Museum. I think, I don't know, we had lots and lots of debates, and a lot of what we settled on was you know, identifying when something in the past what has been picked up on by a modern community under certain labels. So we had, you know, like if any of you are familiar with Vesta Tilly, who is a famous male impersonator, and we had some information about her and some objects related to her. But obviously there's no way to speak to that, you know, if she had any gender variance in herself, and so more instead picked up on sort of the later legacies of, you know, being drawn on by lesbian communities, but also modern trans communities, and so just saying, you know, she was a female impersonator, and now, like, this is the position that she holds in the modern culture for this place in Bolton. Yeah, so I think that was one of the ways that we got around it, was just speaking to, like, which communities are sort of finding ancestry in that now.
Does anybody, more shows of hands? Yes?
I just want to add a little tiny bit to that. Is one of the other things we've done at Bolton Museum is that we've got an archive of Humphrey Spender, and we, as part of my sort of bi history research, it looked like he was a bi man, and we didn't know for definite. So one of the things I would also encourage is if there are family around, contact them and ask if there's somebody that would be happy to use that label. So I rang his widow, and she was like, well, he didn't use that term, but that's absolutely how he would describe himself if he were around now, so I'm happy for you to use it. And that then gave us the permission to use him in examples for things like Bi Visibility Day. So it's another good source of checking terminology.
Hello, my name is Riitta Pakvalainen. I come from Finland, and I was working with I was very interested in your presentation, Louis. I was working with Finland Turned 100, 2017, and so we had a big project on querying national archives and museums and other cultural institutions. And what I'm curious about is to hear, do you know that things changed? Do you see some changes? And another question would be also, what were the concrete things that you were working with?
So one of the things that happened was, so when I was initially brought on as a placement student, it was just to research for the exhibit, and then the timing was supposed to end when sort of everything got done and dusted and sent to the printers. But then we ended up extending it, so I had more just research time. So one of the things that Bolton did is everything had sort of been researched for the project, was then just sitting with the museum catalog and just going through, and they had some objects that people had sort of flagged as potentially related to LGBT history, and I just sat and went through the catalog and was like, okay, what do we have? And then adding information in the actual catalog so that everything is searchable and in there. So that was sort of inbuilt legacy. So it's not just the objects that were part of this exhibit that are now in that, but pretty, I got through most of, I didn't go through the fish samples, but I went through most of the rest of the catalog. what was the second part of the question? It was... Yeah, so I think that's one for Bolton Museum. The exhibit just closed in May, so... So the long terms, but some of the groups that worked with are still meeting in the museum and are now recognize that as a safe space. It was actually great as part of the design of the exhibit. There was a specific area that was meant to be a safe space chill out area. So there were sofas and beanbags put in the space so that youth could come and just hang out there, which was phenomenal. So as for the other institutions, the British Museum is sort of ongoing in what they're doing with it. I can't necessarily speak to what Nottingham's doing, but they are the Museum of Social Justice, so I hope something. And the Ashmolean's in Oxford, so it is part of, they have larger projects that are going. But those ones weren't necessarily invoking the anniversaries and stuff. So I think it might be too soon to call what the long-term impact is, but I think for Bolton, definitely the fact that I was allowed to just sit with the catalog and whatever is going to be one of the biggest sort of longer-term impacts of the project, because even I'm gone, and if Prit ever decides that she needs to go conquer the entirety of the North or something, that's still going to be there and still be part of that legacy.
I thought I might just extend that to the rest of the panel in talking about legacies from perhaps different projects the exhibitions that you've done, like Axis Mundo and other exhibition projects, in terms of ensuring a legacy or a tail to the project, that it isn't just singular, but in perhaps building collections or establishing other programming out of those in an ongoing way.
I guess what I would say about Axis Mundo for us is that it really is fantastic that the Latinx community in Los Angeles, which is a huge portion of our community, sort of didn't know that we existed until we did the Axis Mundo exhibit. But now, actually, we're getting people. Last month, I met two artists from Argentina who'd actually read our book, which I couldn't even believe was true. And then they came to Los Angeles to see where the exhibit had been put on. And then I became friends with them, and they did an exhibition at the Museum of Latin American Art in Long Beach. And then I went down to visit with them, and that sort of started a whole other conversation about them coming back and doing an exhibition with us. And it's really the long-term effects of the exhibition and programming that we're doing has been pretty sustained. I'm amazed at who comes and also at who gives us collections. When people won't give collections, rightly so, if they don't see themselves reflected in the space. And so if you show them their face inside your space, they'll give you their stuff. but they're not going to give it to you if you don't. And so that's been a really big thing for us to do, is to spend a lot of time making sure that people are represented within the context of exhibitions, programming, anything that we do, publications, so that we're attracting those folks to come into the building and to be able to see themselves and to also put their materials, to trust them to us, because then we get trusted.
Our biggest one would be on the 25th anniversary, the National Portrait Collection was founded at our institution. And we now have 75 portraits and additional 4 being created this year for addition. So this was a project that was very much built out of the anniversary, but has been able to continue over the years. And then rapidly, I guess in 2 years, we'll be hitting the 25th anniversary of the portrait collection, and it'll be our 50th year. So, you know, there's already planning going on to how are we going to move this into the next phase? How many portraits are we going to induct? Which kind of people are we going to, you know, be looking for to be inducted? So it's had a major impact, because I would say out of the loans that we've been doing, I would say about 75% of the loan requests are actually from the portrait collection. And there's currently an exhibit going on in Ottawa, and one just closed in Kingston, one just is closing soon in Toronto. So this summer alone, we had 3 different exhibits going on with the portraits.
Any more questions? Yeah, at the back.
Sorry, I realize this may be very specific to Reagan. So I've been a part of an organization named Change as well before, and we found out that it was incredibly awkward when we did the equivalent in French. So I'm wondering if you found the same, and if you came across that and you're kind of trying to change it and say, this is great, oh, it doesn't work, and the other way. So
we made sure that Les Archives was going to, like, be a thing. Keeping in mind that Les Archives Gay de Quebec was also a thing. That was a part of our RFP, actually, because we do have the national mandate. We knew that there's going to be parts of our website and parts of the exhibit for the National Portrait Collections that was going to be in English and French, because we have several inductees that are Francophone and had their statements in French already. So it was built into our RFP that we would make sure that it worked in French and in English.
Yeah, fantastic. Sure. Sure.
Thank you. I was wondering about the Canadian archive. I missed what you said about building collections through building relationships. Could you expand on that a bit?
Yep. So one of our main concerns was not just parachuting into communities that were underrepresented, but rather hiring community members who would be able to come in and work with us. In some cases, we were teaching them RAD standards, which is a Canadian archival standards. And then we kind of set them loose in their community and said, what collections are important to you? You bring us those collections, we will take care of them. And in some cases, we went through interview process where the donors actually came in and interviewed us about whether or not they felt we were the right place to put the collection. And then eventually we'd move on to the next step, which is the donation. So we've done this as kind of a case study with the trans community first, and now we're working on and have started already receive funding to hire a Two-Spirit community member to make sure that our Indigenous collections are being worked on by Indigenous people, and that this is like the starting of relationships, not just starting of making our collection more tokenistic.
I think there's another
Hi, I'm Terry with the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco. And my question is really around collections policies. And I really appreciated everybody's ideas around diversifying collections, and we're working very hard on that as well. And with respect to collecting outside your particular region and working with other archives, and especially nationally and internationally, I'm wondering how do you navigate that in terms of taking in collections from outside your specific region, and how did you come up with those policies?
The policies are actually for us that we pretty much don't have any money to buy anything. So we don't go after anything. What happens is people call us up and say they're going to give us materials, and usually that's what happens. What I've just experienced in the last 4 or 5 months is we also get community members who insist that we take collections. And that's a bigger problem for us, because sometimes they're not collections that we wanted to go after, but they're collections that these community members feel like belong in our archive, and so therefore they make some sort of an insistent plea, and then we end up having to accept them. But there's also a lot of collections that we turn down, and mostly because of the fact that if they're duplicated materials within our collection already, there's no sense in us taking them, but we will direct people to go to other archives to donate them. We also try not to, we try to fill in gaps in the collection is a policy that we have. So if we have a full run of something or a partial run of something, then we're always on the lookout to add that to it. But one of the things that's been happening as a phenomenon in the United States is that many of the regional archives have been getting more and more regional. And so they've sloughed off some of the materials that they had that were international, and we end up getting them in the mail, which has been something that's happened relatively frequently. So because I've always felt that we wanted to be a sort of, we wanted to have a global gaze, I think that we're continuing to accept materials, especially in other languages, because it's really important to our researchers to be able to have those.
So our collection policy specifically says by or about Canada as the primary focus. However, we've got a secondary focus, which is international material. And that's reflected in our subject files, which are research files. We call them vertical files, which do include the United States and other international communities. So if it's Canadian, it's kind of like an automatic yes, as long as it's not a duplicate, we'll try to find a way to make it work. But in some cases, we do refer people to the provincial associations, because many of the provinces do have individual LGBTQ2+ collections. Sometimes they're at universities or housed within larger archival institutions, so they're more like collections within a colonial or university or state archive. But we kind of try to make sure that if the collection is national in scope and we can accommodate it, we will. And everything else, especially artwork, right now we're turning down a lot of artwork just because we don't have the space for it. We try to make sure that it's going to another institution that can accommodate it.
I just wanted to follow up on one of those, I guess. In terms of the digitization of material where it's non-English language, and also where there is from communities that there may be risks involved in making material available online, as in criminalization in local communities, has there been any concerns about making material available in that context?
If there's any risks, then we don't digitize. We're not doing, we're doing a lot of specific digitization for our online exhibits, and we're being very focused in what we do and do not digitize. That being said, if you listen to the Don's talk with Gail about our digitizing with them, it's on a much larger scale, but right now we're focusing on making sure that our online exhibits are kind of dealt with, and we're making sure that the material that's going up is not in any way a risk to anybody. We don't want anybody getting doxxed. But we're just also not at the point where we can do large-scale digitization internally without the support of an organization like Gale.
Ditto. We do a lot of digitization. We've done 4 digitization projects in 2 years. We just did completed a project with Clear for, I think, something like 5,000 posters in our collection. We've digitized a lot of other stuff. In terms of danger for those things, the first collection was from a lesbian woman that I mentioned before, who's 98, who I go and visit on an almost every other month basis. And she initially didn't want her collection to be digitized, and she didn't even want it to be available to people. And then eventually she gave up on that one and sort of said, yeah, you can let people see it. And then eventually it came to, well, you can let people see it, and you can let people do research in it and all that sort of thing. And so then that happened. And so finally it was, she agreed to digitizing it, and then her niece saw her collection online and wrote a paper in high school about it. And then she became very proud, and now she's really excited about having everything digitized. So these kinds of things happen in incremental ways. And yes, as far as the Chinese materials that we have, for instance, I'm very concerned about that in that case. But the community that is in question actually requested to have the materials digitized so they can have access to them. So that's one of those that's really hard to make a decision about. But we have lots of collections where we have those kinds of problems. And also, we have AIDS collections, for instance, in which there are people named that came to us in the 1980s. And we just don't allow people access to them because we think it's too early for people to have access to those. In some cases, they're redacted. So.
Okay. Oh, yep.
We were running a bit ahead, so we've still got a bit of time. So please still think on your questions.
Hi, I'm Melle with the University of Cologne, and I have a question that kind of like relates to space when diversifying the archives. I mean, you already addressed a little bit the other major concern of archives and museum collections, which is volunteers or manpower, if you want to call it that. And the other one is storage space. Most smaller archives are really concerned of where to put what and how much intake they can manage. So I was just wondering how your institutions are dealing with that, and or if space maybe may not be a problem in North American archives. I don't know. But yeah, if you could comment on that, I would be really interested. Thanks.
Space is a major issue. Right now, if you try to go into my office, there is a tower of Hollinger boxes that will greet you. Because there's no space. However, we have 2 offsite storage spaces. So what we have been doing in the case of artifacts is photographing them and placing them offsite. That includes several thousand t-shirts. In other case, because we're in Toronto and there's literally a world-class library down the street, we also put a lot of the fiction from our library in that in our off-site storage, because we know that there's other ways for people to get those books. If there wasn't, or if there is no other way for them to get material that we have, then we do bring it back on site. So we're trying to prioritize the material that's getting used the most, but also making sure that we're making space, because that is actually what needs to happen, is that, you know, these are organizations that and spaces that white men have held for a really long time, and unless they're willing to actually physically make space for the other people in the community, then there's not going to be a lot of change. So I have no trouble, and I don't worry about making space physically as much, because there's ways around it. But making sure that we're giving space to those new collections is kind of a priority for us.
Space for us wasn't an issue until relatively recently. Now we have no space. We've taken up every single inch of space within the building. We're having difficulty. One of the things, I've just hired a new curator, and I'm hoping that she will be able to de-access some of our artworks, because we have artworks that came to us as parts of individuals who had a legacy of collecting, but they don't necessarily all seem in scope to me, and so what we're going to have to do is begin to think about how we de-access some of those materials. We also have off-site storage, but it's not adequate, and it's awful. I mean, just to let you know how poor we are, we didn't have air conditioning until last year. And the building itself, everybody says that one of the things that's wonderful about coming to us is that materials get delivered to them within 10, 15, 20 minutes. So everything is there in the building. We don't want to start moving things too far away. But the last thing I'll say about that is, I told you that I'm planning on retiring in 3 years. So my goal is that in 3 years, when I've retired, I want them to break ground on a new building. And so I'm going to try and get a capital campaign started before then. That's my prayer. We'll see if it works. But at any rate, we need an entirely new building, something that's almost double the size of what we are now, because we'd like to continue collecting.
Collection, you know, one thing about archives is they generally don't decrease in size. Any more questions? I think we've got a few more minutes. No? Okay, yep, one up the back, wonderful.
We've heard quite a lot about sort of the legacy for the institutions and for the collections. I was wondering, the three speakers, about what you felt the legacy of the different projects you've worked on you personally, about how you work with this stuff going forwards.
Great question.
So one of the things for me is, obviously I was at the Bolton exhibit, but it just personally is fed back into my research. So my research is looking at museums that have had exhibits that have specifically tried to include trans history, and the British Museum version of Desire, Love, Identity is actually one of my case studies. So, right now I'm coming to the end of writing my PhD and getting to write very literally what happened. And also after studying the collection and getting to get my hands on it in a later form and then changing what I didn't like about the original exhibit was a very exciting thing for me. But also, I spent all this time writing about things and then actually getting to get my hands on it and how to do things, and it opened my eyes to certain things like... when we were coming actually fairly close to opening the Bolton exhibit, I approached Perrette and one of the other managers and was like, we don't actually have anything that explicitly says is like a non-binary object in the exhibit. Can I donate some of my badges? And they were like, oh, yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. And it was great, and they've been acquisitioned by the museum, and they're now part of the permanent collection, and they're on display centrally. And, like I said, Bolton Museum is... and incredibly, the staff there has been incredibly welcoming, and the exhibit would have been phenomenal either way. But also, my body being in that space as a non-binary person to say, like, hey, are we thinking about how we're doing this inclusion? It might not have got done if I wasn't there, which was sort of eye-opening. We're like, oh, even people with the best intentions, need pushing. And I don't obviously mean that anyway against the Institute, but just sort of that sort of kick in the rear to actually like speak up all the time and in every single room. And also just the idea that I feel like a lot of times there's general conversations. I feel we can get very caught up in the really big conversations, and also being somewhere like Bolton, which is a very small civic museum in a very small city in the north of England, and to see the kind of change that can happen by people who are just very passionate about it is really heartening and makes you go, okay, actually maybe we're making some changes in places. So that's been a wonderful thing.
The big one for me as a trained archivist and someone who worked as an archivist before I became an executive director, it was kind of a transition out of school where it was all theory into just having to just do things and get it done and figure out ways to get it done. And so it's really been all these projects, including the name change, has really got me motivated for more of my work, including my PhD thesis and my other research that I do outside of the organization, to, rather than just talk about it, to how are we going to act on it, and making sure that there are case studies in place so that other organizations, have a guide and can say, okay, this is how they did it. Here's how, maybe how we can help make our project possible.
I don't know if I have anything to say to that one, actually. I mean,
sure. I have a question for Joseph. One is part of the USC system now, right? So you talked about that you would help to start a capital campaign. And I was wondering about the relationship with the university about funding for your archive. How responsible are they, or would they would start the capital campaign for you?
I hate doing this out in public, but I will say they're penurious. They've been horrible. They pay very little. They pay for three positions for the, and my position, so four altogether. And I think that they think that's more than enough. So it's been really difficult. We just lost our curator after the last exhibit that I described to you. And when he left, they actually came to me and told me that they weren't going to hire someone to replace him, despite the fact that the exhibit had won 7 awards and had gone to 6 or 7 different cities. And so I had to fight all the way up the ladder to get that done. And I've just hired a new curator, but it's everything's a fight. And I think part of that's because it's an enormous institution, and that enormous institution does that. We also have a foundation that works sometimes in tandem with what we want, but so far that hasn't been yielding a lot of funding for the archive itself, or at least not a substantial amount that I would like to have, as substantial an amount. So we're basically forced to produce a great deal with very little resources, and I think that it's being a part of the university, though, has brought great things. We have access to computers. We have access to technical knowledge that we wouldn't have had. We have access to other things. But if it hadn't been for the foundation complaining to the university, which the university doesn't listen to me because they pay my salary, so the foundation complained to the university, and they were, in fact, the ones who got us the air conditioning to some extent. So I think that that's really, that's, you know, it's always going to be a kind of struggle, but it was also a struggle when we were depending upon the community, because the archive is just so large that I don't think any community would ever be able to fully support it to the standards that it really needs. So it's always going to be a struggle. It's just a huge archive, and it needs a lot of care and feeding.
Okay, well, if there's no further questions, we might wrap it up. Can everybody please thank our panelists?